Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. We are back today, this time with Chris Madej from the Pain Podcast. And what we're going to talk about is something that we're going to say Chris is an expert on, and maybe less so for me, and that's going to be chemotherapy and its complications. So Chris, can you go ahead and introduce yourself again real quick?
Yeah, hello everybody. I'm excited to be back on Total EM Podcast. My name is Chris Madej. I'm the host of the Pain Podcast, which stands for Physician Assistant Education. And as guests, I am a program director and associate professor at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis. So I am a full-time academician. So I guess because I teach for a living, this makes me an expert on all things non-emergency medicine in Chip's mind. So that's kind of where we were going with this particular topic today.
Well, and I mean, I don't even know what the hell chemo is. So yeah, I guess you're going to have a huge leg on me. And you got all the brains, man. I'm just here pressing the record button. So you're going to teach me everything, right?
Well, that's what I try to do every single day. Sometimes it's better, a little bit better than others, but we will certainly give it a go.
All right. Well, I guess we should go ahead and get into it.
What it comes down to is both of this is, in full disclosure, you know, this particular topic is probably outside of both of our comfort zones, just because this is such a small niche of providers just in general, let alone PAs that work in hematology and oncology. But the way that I sort of was approaching this was, I think that all subspecialties in medicine are going to come across a patient who has either been treated by chemo or is currently on chemo. Certainly from an emergency room standpoint, you're going to be dealing a lot more with the complications, and that's the bulk of what we're going to talk about today. But in order for us to sort of lay the groundwork of it, I figured we would do more of an academic approach to it and talk about some of the basics behind chemotherapy and why we see the complications that we see. And then, like I said, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of the complications. So to sort of start off with, just to sort of lay the groundwork, the CDC estimates about 650,000 patients per year receive outpatient chemotherapy. And since chemotherapy is designed to kill rogue cancer cells, and depending on the type that you use, some of them are either by sniper, some of them are by nukes, you're bound to have some collateral damage from chemotherapy. And that's kind of where this podcast came in, was we need to talk about chemotherapy in and of itself is going to do damage. That's what it's designed to do. We hope that the collateral damage is going to be as low as possible, but we do need to talk about some of the inevitable side effects that you're going to see with it. So when you talk about the chemotherapy, the main thing, and pretty much all pharmacotherapeutic agents, is talking about the therapeutic index. And when you think back to school, when you took your pharm class, you remember that graph that talked about the therapeutic effect and the toxic effect of all medications. And that the difference between those two, the space between therapeutic index and toxic effect, is the therapeutic index. You want to have, for all medicines, you want to have as big of a therapeutic index as possible, because it gives you room for error. You can have some variability in your dosing schedule without either being subtherapeutic or toxic. The problem is that with chemotherapy, that therapeutic index is extremely narrow. You have to dial in that dose so perfect so that you're not only getting the effects that you want, but you're limiting the toxic effect. And when those two lines are right over top of each other, you're going to have some issues. And that is why you see a lot of the problems and the complications associated with chemotherapy. Now, there are several different types of chemotherapy. We're not going to go through this. This is by no means going to be a review of all the chemotherapeutic agents. But again, from an academic standpoint, I think we need to talk about at least the certain classes. So the first global class that you're going to come across are your direct DNA interacting agents. And there's two main subtypes underneath alkylating agents, which are cisplatin, carboplatin, cyclophosphamide. Those are ones you're probably most common, most familiar with. And then you also have your anti-tumor antibiotics, or your topoisomerase poisons. And those are bleomycin and doxorubicin. They're the two most commons that you're going to see with those two. You also have indirect DNA interacting agents. Most common one that should come to mind are the anti-metabolites, 5-fluorouracil or 5-FU. Methotrexate falls into this as well as azathioprine and 6-mercaptopurine. Your anti-mitotic agents are vincristine, your hormone receptor targeted agents or tamoxifen and diethylstilbestrol that you see with breast cancers and ovarian cancers. Protein kinase antagonists, imatinib is the more common of those. Multikinase inhibitors, sorafenib, proteasome inhibitors, or bortezomib. And we're probably going to stop right there just because I don't think I can pronounce any of these other ones. But those are the types of chemotherapeutic agents that you come across. Why do you need to know this? And Chip, you might be able to comment a little bit on this in the ER. As I know, I've had patients before who, for whatever reason, you have one side of the spectrum where they just tell you that I take a small white pill and they describe the pill in detail, but they can't tell you what it is. And then you have a whole nother subset of patients who will actually tell you the type of chemotherapy that they're on and list that under their med reconciliation. So if you don't know at least some of these medicines, they might actually come across on your med rec and you might glaze right over them and not even think about it. Have you had that any experience like that before?
Oh yeah. And this is something that, when I see any patient with a history of cancer, I don't rely on the med rec, even though we have some great med recs at my main shop. I don't rely on just looking at the medicine. But these days though, I kind of do one of two things. So if I look and see that they have a history of cancer, I make sure to ask if they're on chemotherapy or radiation. Obviously some patients are not that great of historians. So if I don't get a great story, I'll look it up myself as best I can. Our MedRec techs do a great job with that. And if I see a name that just kind of like what you did there, it's like, okay. So I go start looking it up. That's what a great thing like, again, no endorsements of anything in particular, just it's what I use personally, Epocrates.
Mm-hmm.
Get no money from them, actually paid them money instead, so that's not funny me. But anyway, seriously, I use these types of things because it helps out. And there are other great apps that also have other pill identifiers. So I've actually had patients who bring in their nice little week-long pill set, you know, box. And like, yeah, these are the pills I take. That's great. None of them have a name on it. So, nope. A great little thing's a pill identifier. I've actually used this at 36,000 feet when I had a mix of pills in one bottle. And yep. There was an airline emergency, and I was kind of the one who got to deal with it. Epocrates, again, is a really great app, and it goes offline, and you can actually look at pills offline. I hope it still has that feature. That's been a few years back.
I'm pretty sure it does.
So not that you're probably going to have this emergency with chemotherapy at 36,000 feet, but it's a hell of a great thing to have when you need it.
Right.
And the reason why I bring this all up is because for me, this is something that's a common issue. If I have a patient who could be treated with chemotherapy or recently treated with chemotherapy, this changes how we're going to manage this patient drastically. Someone who comes in with a sore throat now is a much more urgent deal because of the potential things they could have been exposed to and could have gotten that, you know, every day you and I are probably not going to have an issue with.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's very, very important for me to know what medicines I'm dealing with. And I'm not going to know, I kind of admit I glossed over when I just listened to you talk about these medicines. But at least I get, you know, the idea of, okay, this is what I need to look up. And this is kind of the basic mechanism of what we're dealing with. And then I'll get whoever I need to, who's much smarter than me, to back me up and help me with telling me what I'm supposed to do.
Right. And, you know, the main chemotherapeutics that you're probably most familiar with are going to be your infusions that, you know, the patient's not going to be taking at home. But I will tell you, in preparation for this podcast and doing my research and due diligence, there are a lot of other chemotherapeutic agents out there that are daily dosed oral medications. So yeah, they may be bringing them in or telling you that they're on this medicine and just forget to drop that dime that, oh yeah, by the way, I've got lung cancer. You know, but these are the medicines that I'm on. So in this day and age, it really does help to at least know a little bit about them. And certainly if something chimes in that doesn't really make a lot of sense, don't discount the fact that they could be on some chemotherapeutic agent, which again is going to change your approach to the patient depending on what they're presenting with.
Just remember 5-FU for the cool name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you always got to think that if you're treating cancer, you want to have something like that where you can just kind of walk in and just go 5-FU and just like a battle cry every single time, like in Braveheart. So let's dive into some of the complications. So the first one that I think is probably the most important to know just from all clinical aspects is this, the complication of myelosuppression. So chemotherapy, by definition, is designed to destroy cells. Now, the problem is a lot of those cells that it destroys, even if it's targeted, it's still going to affect your bone marrow, and bone marrow is going to be suppressed. Certainly when you start dealing with some of your, your liquid cancers like AML, ALL, some of your lymphomas, the whole point of the chemotherapy is to do what's called myeloablation, which is to completely destroy the bone marrow and start from scratch. But if this is a chemotherapy that you're using for another type of cancer, it still may affect your white blood cell count. And that's really what happens with this, is you get so myelosuppressed that you can actually have an acquired neutropenia. And neutropenia is one of those things that if you don't know what you're looking for, you may miss it. And it really is not just a low white blood cell count. I've seen many people think that neutropenia is just a low white blood cell count. And it's not. It can be, but it takes into account your PMNs as well as your bands. And what ends up happening then is you can have somebody with a low white count who is not neutropenic, but you can have somebody with a normal white blood cell count and still be neutropenic. So you really have to look at the differential when it comes to the white blood cell count in somebody who's had chemotherapy, because it really can make a difference in how you're going to manage them.
Well, and just to quickly iterate there, because that's a very, very important point, I think we need to stress this a little bit, is this is a common mistake for anyone who's like in school or just fresh out of school. I'm sure I made this mistake along the way. Not Chris, though. He's a genius, so we'll leave him out of this. But most of the rest of us
humans... I made
humans,
a mistake once, but I was wrong.
You probably got quickly corrected. That's the thing, is that if you have a good preceptor or a good collaborating physician, if you're a PA or MP or whoever, I mean, someone's going to come in there and say, no, this is not neutropenic. This is just a low white count. Or they would say, hey, did you notice the absolute neutrophil count? Did you realize they're neutropenic even with the normal white count in there? So It's important to pay attention to this, because it's really the neutropenia that's going to define the illness. And when you have a neutropenic fever, becomes a much bigger deal, which we're going to be talking about here in a second.
Exactly. And that fever, or really the neutropenia, can be anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks from the initial chemotherapy. So this is not immediate, but it can be anywhere in sort of the subacute time frame of 2 to 6 weeks. And really the only presenting symptom that can be an ominous finding is a febrile episode. So just like we say, a fever in a infant under 30 days old is an issue, a fever in a cancer patient is an issue. It's not, you can't just write that off. You've got to do your due diligence, and you've got to investigate this, because if this is a febrile, like Chip said, if this is a neutropenic fever, then you got to go full blast on this. So what is your definition of neutropenia? Now, you can go to the show notes, because you've got to just look at the calculation, or you can get a med calc, you can do all sorts of stuff. But basically what it is the definition of neutropenia is an ANC, or an absolute neutrophil count, that is less than 1,500 cells per microliter. And we calculate that by using their total white blood cell count as a decimal, and then you add the percentages of your neutrophils and your bands and multiply that by 10. So it's a calculation. You just got to plug the numbers in. I have seen one EMR that will calculate an ANC on every single patient, very similar to how they do a serum osmolality with your electrolytes. So sometimes they'll just go ahead and do it. But this is just one of those numbers that you got to know. ANC of less than 1,500 is the definition of neutropenia.
And some labs will actually, and I think that's growing, a lot of labs will do your ANC for you, but it's not a bad idea to still calculate this yourself, because they may not always be using the same equation.
Right. So just knowing what it is, and knowing at least how to calculate it if you need to, is going to go a long way in terms of trying to figure out if somebody's neutropenic, because we're going to get to the management of somebody who's got neutropenia here in a second and what that entails. Now, why is it so important that we diagnose somebody with neutropenia? Well, they're at risk for a host of different things. And the most common risk assessment that you can do is called the MASC index. And MASC stands for Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer. And again, you go to the show notes, you can find the table of what you're going to look at with this. But basically what it is it's a composite score anywhere from 0 to 26 based on the burden of illness, which is the severity of symptoms, either no symptoms, moderate symptoms, or severe symptoms. And again, that can mean, you know, whatever kind of symptoms that they're having. Their comorbidities. So are they hypotensive? Do they have COPD? Is this a solid tumor or a hematologic malignancy without a history of a fungal infection? Because again, that raises your risk as well. Is there any dehydration that's requiring IV fluids? The status of the patient, is this an outpatient status? Did they come in to clinic? Or is this somebody who's coming to the emergency room or somebody that you're evaluating in the hospital? That does play a role. The age of the patient, if they're less than 60 or they're greater than 60, and then points. And basically what you're looking at is a patient who's got 21 to 26 points is low risk. So the more points you have, the better in this particular score. I wish that when we start talking about all of these stupid risk scores and everything else, I wish we could all just get on the same page in terms of is this score more points better or no points better? Is a positive test negative or is a negative test positive? I just really wish that there was some way that we could just go back in time and somebody just needed to drop the hammer and say from this point out, all risk assessments, the more points, the worse. Why they decided to do this, I have no idea.
Maybe your buddy Osler, we could go back in time, tell him, and we can fix it that way.
I'll tell you what, if I could go back in time and party with Osler for a night, I mean, him and I think we could do some damage.
Quick question, though, because I think this is something we need to talk about real quick, for my end at least. What about so we talked about status, the outpatient status at time of neutropenic fever. What about the person who comes in because their oncologist got their labs because they worked their labs today and, oh my gosh, they're neutropenic. And they said, you have to go to the hospital to be evaluated, because that never happens, by the way.
Right.
That'd be considered more of an outpatient status, right? They wouldn't have come in had it not been for their oncologist saying, you need to get checked out. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about that. Would you agree? Is that kind of what this points to? Or
I think so. When I was researching this and looking at it, I think that's exactly what that's how that would entail. Was it was out, you know, if the patient was not in the hospital at the time when they had the neutropenia diagnosed, then I think that everybody gets three at that point. I think this is just for your patients that are admitted to the hospital for other pathologies, or maybe they're in the hospital getting chemotherapy and then they spike a fever, then they would not be, you know, considered for that. But I think they didn't really go into big depths about it, but I think you can get I think you can kind of fudge it a little bit depending on, you know, what it is. Really what it comes down to is, you know, how bad do they look when they're coming in? You know, do they look sick and they had a neutropenic fever? Well, that's going to be a lot different than somebody who is, you know, on death's door and then, oh my God, you got a white count expecting it to be 30,000 in septic and, oh, nope, other way. You know, he's got a white count of 0.2 and he's got no bands and, you know, now it's a neutropenic sepsis, which is, again, a whole nother bag of worms. So the reason why you want to do this risk score is the management of patients vastly differs between whether they're low risk or they're high risk. So based on your MASC score is then going to dictate how much of a risk they are for acquiring an infection. So the first thing that you want to do, especially if you're in the clinic, it's going to be a little bit different. This is really more geared towards the emergency medicine brethren here is
Woo-hoo!
as soon as you diagnose somebody with neutropenia or you see that, then it immediately becomes contact precautions only in the hospital. Everybody who goes in and out of that room, and this also is family or visitors in the room. I've had a patient that I remember who was a kid who came in with a neutropenic fever, and he had, you know, seven of his buddies there, and we had to gown them all up and do everything while we were shipping them off to Children's.
And they're all coughing and sniffling and sneezing in the room, probably. Right,
exactly. So as soon as you diagnose somebody with a neutropenic fever, then everybody gets gowns, gloves, hats, masks. Basically, everything needs to be limited in terms of contacting this patient, because anybody at this point, even if you've got a common cold, could be deadly for the patient. So that's really one of the more important things to do right off the bat is if you're not really sure what to do with them, then the least you can do is make sure that everybody's got all this stuff. And most of the places that I've worked at, they've got a contact precautions cart that they just wheel to the bedside or at least outside the room, and they put the sign on the door that says, you know, contact precautions. Does that sound about right in your shop too?
Yeah, we actually have little bags that have all the stuff, and there's different cards in them telling you what to do. And there's a couple of things I want to point out here real quick that I think is something worth mentioning. Have a very, very low threshold. Don't wait for the test to decide that this person needs to be on isolation. When you make first contact, I don't care if you're the nurse, the tech, you know, the PA, doc, whatever, I don't care. If there's any chance in any history or any suspicion for cancer, you need to ask if they've been on chemotherapy recently. For me, I'm just overly abundant. So, you know, we talked about 2 to 6 weeks for neutropenic fever. I'm even asking like 2 months out. So if we have any risk, any general idea, I want them on reverse isolation to start off with. And I want everyone to go in there to just assume that they are sick to start with. And this is one that I know vaccines hotly debated. I don't care. For me, this is one where I'm going to always have the conversation. If I get even get the inkling of a chance to talk about how the people in the room who are visiting the family and, you know, whoever else, they need to get vaccinated, because if they're not up to date on their vaccines, this is the person they're going to kill. And this is what I get nervous about, is I get people who are having neutropenic fevers who've gotten flu this year. And that's a really, really bad thing to do. These are people who can honestly die from this. And right. we ignore this point. So for me, it doesn't matter, visitor, provider, whatever. If you're going to go into this room and you're going to assess this patient, even if you're not sick, this is someone you really need to be very, very cautious with and have as much precautions as possible as far as how you protect yourself and how you protect them. Because really, this is not like the MRSA, that the abscess you're about to drain, that you're worried about getting it on you or spreading it throughout the hospital because you go and visit the next patient. This is quite the opposite. You're trying to protect the patient because you may have stuff on you from draining that abscess from that last patient or wherever else. This is someone you got to be extremely cautious with. And I do not believe you take this lightly. This is the one patient that really is consistently sticking out of my mind that we have to be extremely careful with.
Right. There is no too much in patients with neutropenic fever in regards to non-pharmacologic management. Pharmacologic management, things have changed a little bit, which we'll touch about, you know, here in a second. But, you know, contact precautions, everything else in the room. If you've got, you know, I've seen some shops that have even put neutropenic fever patients in the TB rooms with negative pressure.
That's actually one of the things we try and do when we can. We only have one room like that, but we'll do it if they're a high risk.
Exactly. So any of those precautions that you can do while you're waiting for other labs or waiting for the specialists to come back, you should be doing to try to limit the chance that this patient could be getting sick. I mean, there's a reason why we say that, you know, don't come to the hospital unless you need to, because you can get sick while you're there. These are the patients who really need to not be in the hospital unless they're in a protected environment because of everything that's around them, especially in the ED where you've got sick people all over the place. How do you manage them? So from a broad spectrum antibiotic standpoint, that's what you need to do. You need to cover for the most common pathogens. And this is the main reason why you do your risk assessment, is in low risk patients, depending on how they look and everything else, then what the current guidelines are saying is outpatient oral antibiotics are fine. And what they recommend is both ciprofloxacin with amoxicillin clavulanate. Both of those cover the majority of your pathogens. You got Cipro that covers for Pseudomonas. You've got your amoxicillin or your Augmentin that's going to cover for most of your gram-positives. And they should have a pretty quick follow-up with their oncologist. So if you're in a setting where you know that it's a patient who's got good follow-up or is a very compliant patient, then, yeah, oral antibiotics and have them follow up the next day. If they are high risk or you're really worried about other things and maybe they're on the, you know, maybe they're on the high side of low, then the initial management should be monotherapy. It used to be that we would do, you know, a vanc, a zosyn, a second pseudomonal agent, maybe even add some antifungals. And, you know, we would go 4 or 5 deep on these guys. And what they found was it really doesn't help all that much, at least in the initial assessment. So the most important thing about your initial monotherapy is that it's got to be an anti-pseudomonal agent. So piperacillin, tazobactam, or zosyn is going to be your go-to for that. Most shops have this, and it's of the other choices, it's probably the cheaper. Meropenem, inupenem also helps, and your fourth generation cepapheme can be helpful. Ceftaz is okay. It's good for anti-pseudomonal, but I don't think it covers as much as the other bugs. And then certainly if the clinical scenario suggests further coverage, well, then you can start throwing the vanc on. Is this a patient who's had an MRSA infection? Is this somebody who was in the hospital recently and is at risk for MRSA? Well, then certainly you're going to want to add vanc to that. metronidazole for patients with maybe a surgical abdomen who you're worried about anaerobic coverage, and then certainly your antivirals and your antifungals as needed. But, you know, the take-home point that hopefully you're going to get from this podcast is that it's not, you know, full Gatling gun style on these patients. You want to make sure if they're high risk, just make sure that you're covering for Pseudomonas. Think about other things that you might need to put them on, vanc and antivirals and antifungals, depending on the scenario. Contact your infectious disease, you know, docs, ask them for help. But don't give them any unnecessary antimicrobials, because these patients may be on them for, you know, another 6 or 8 weeks. So you don't want to start something that they don't necessarily need.
If you're like me and you're in the rural setting, what's infectious disease? You have that department somewhere?
So somebody does something with the antibiotics.
Oh!
You know, it's the guy that calls you when you're trying to order a drug that the patient needs, and they says you can't. You have to page them and talk to them directly because they don't want to release it to everybody in the hospital. You know that guy.
That's my pharmacist. So I don't have infectious disease. We have oncology, though. And that's what I was going to say, is that realistically, when you're in a rural shop, whether or not you actually have oncology there, it is important to talk to the oncologist of the patient or someone in that group, because they're going to better know the patient than you are. You're most likely seeing them for their very first time. Medical legally too, that's a very important step to take, because you are dealing with some heavy guns and you're going to deal with a patient who's pretty darn sick at the time. Something I'd like to point out here, not only just talking about the specialists and talking about who you may want to talk to, let's talk a little bit about a clinical scenario that's happening this time of year. We just kind of mentioned it briefly. Influenza, a little timely thing right now. You've got all these different medications that are out there. There's even now one that's infusion type. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But they're all different types of antivirals that you can use. I know there's a lot of debate about just how affected these may be for your typical flu cases. But this is probably the type of patient where this is why we don't want to exhaust our resources on these antivirals, even if there is debate about just how effective they are for a general population. Because these are really sick patients, or can be really sick. Keep in mind, say you talk to your oncologist or that ID doctor, that mysterious ID doctor that doesn't exist anywhere where I work at. When you do talk to these people, don't be surprised if they are saying, let's add the Zos and the piperacillin, tazobactam, or whatever antibiotics like cefepime or something. The reason why is because these are patients that are higher risk of having co-infection. So yes, they do have influenza A or B, but they also have a high risk of having something else. Don't just count on the obvious diagnosis in these patients, because you can miss something really important.
Well, we had a rash of deaths in Alabama. When was I in the ED last? Probably 3 or 4 years ago. And it was patients who came in with influenza, but would get a florid strep pneumo sepsis from their pneumonia that occurred because their immunobarrier in their lungs was damaged by the influenza. And the providers that were in the hospital were not covering for bacterial infections because they tested flu positive, so they were just on antivirals. So what Chip is saying is 100% is just because you have, you know, I tell my students all the time, which was a nice pearl that somebody told me when I was in school, is the most common diagnosis that is missed is always the second one. If you go looking for something and you find it, don't stop. You got to make sure that you think about other things. Just because somebody comes in with influenza does not mean that you don't then cover for community acquired or hospital acquired pneumonia, or think about you know, some of these other infectious conditions, because if you do that, then these patients are going to get sicker and possibly die on you.
Now, remember, this does not translate for your typical outpatient person. So the guy who comes in with influenza A and may have a little bit of lung stuff, but he's doing well. He doesn't look like a sick patient. You're going to send him home. That doesn't mean to start pouring on the antibiotics on top of the antivirals. If it's an appropriate patient, you know, who's fine otherwise, don't worry about that. But again, these are very sick patients we're talking about. Even if they don't look sick, they're still very sick patients. We need to keep that in mind.
Precisely.
Sorry, antibiotic stewardship going on here. Nothing important.
No, well, and that's one of those things that we need to try to hammer home as much as possible. So, you know, the next big complication that you're going to see, which is probably what everybody is most common with or most familiar with, and this is nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy. This can be absolutely awful. I have seen patients come in who are just dying from retching, and they just, there's nothing left to, for it to come up, and they just can't stop. They are absolutely miserable, and you just feel so bad for them because you're throwing all sorts of stuff at them, and you just can't seem to get them to stop stop retching. And this is such a bad complication of chemotherapy. And I found a really good graphic online that we're going to include in the show notes that just sort of shows you the physiology of chemo-induced emesis and all of the different branch points of where it can be affected. And it kind of helps you when you start looking at the management and the different drugs that you can use for that. But really what it comes down to is there is a grading system that you can use. The National Cancer Institute actually put out a report on all the common complications that you see with cancer, and it's currently in version 4.0. And there's a sort of grading scale for nausea and vomiting, and there's actually different. You can have a grade one nausea, or a grade for nausea and a grade for vomiting. And again, if you go to the show notes, you can kind of see that. But it's basically breaking down the episodes of emesis, whether or not it's affecting their oral intake, and then obviously whether or not there's some life threatening consequences that are occurring with this.
And this time, it's better to have a low number than a high number.
Right, exactly. We're getting right back to the whole thing. You want to be grade one. You do not want to be grade five in this particular risk assessment scale. So I'm going to start with the drugs that I think we're most familiar with, and these are your 5-HT3 drugs. These are your ondansetron or Zofran, and those particular medications. Those you can actually dose, a lot higher than your 4 milligrams, your 8 milligrams that you're probably used to for your ODTs and your IVs. The current recommendations is about 0.1 per kilo. And so you can go pretty high with these. So don't be afraid to hammer these patients with your 5-HT3 drugs. Now you got to be careful because it can cause some extra pyramidal reactions like you see with some of the atypical or your typical antipsychotics. But in somebody who is actively dying from retching, they would much rather have that than the other.
I know there's been some debate about QT prolongation stuff and whether or not how true it is, the data and stuff like that. But when considering ondansetron, if you're going to go with these high doses, it may not be a bad idea, again, a little bit medical legally, but also just good patient care, to at least consider doing an EKG first to look about QT prolongation, look if there's going to be any concerns there. Just because if you're going to have to go to these high doses, you may want to just have that in your mind and consider this as someone who you're going to be a little more cautious with. Just, again, food for thought there.
Or look to see, is there an old EKG that you can look at, or maybe even put them on telemetry while you're dosing them, just so that somebody is looking at it and they're not just sitting there waiting to go into a weird, funky rhythm.
Exactly. Is that what you define as a weird, funky rhythm?
That's one of them. There's several of those in there, but that's one of them that I worry about.
WFR, I like that.
It's always a good idea to co-dose this with some dexamethasone. Your steroids are going to be really helpful, and there is some synergistic effect with that. Those are going to be your two common drugs that you're going to use. The other ones, which I actually had to look up, I'd never heard of before, are these neurokinin 1 receptor antagonists, your NK1s. And these are your, it looks like the suffix of these are the prepitants. And these are pretty heavy guns. You're probably not going to see these in your regular community hospitals, but if you're in a university setting or somewhere where they do a lot of chemotherapy, you may have access to these. So for those of you that are working in the ED, of a major medical center and you have somebody who comes in, you probably have access to these drugs, and these are much more potent, and much more effective, if you have somebody who's coming in with really, really bad emesis. So that's pretty much nausea and vomiting. The main thing with it is assess volume, try to get them to calm down a little bit. Think about your QT intervals when you start dealing with your 5-HT3 high doses, and otherwise just try to get them to stop vomiting. For the most part, this is not going to be profoundly life-threatening unless they've been vomiting for, days on end and they've got significant electrolyte imbalances. But if this is just somebody coming in, you just got to try to get it under control, and you just got to think about some of the adjuncts that you wouldn't normally give somebody who's just got a, regular old stomach flu. The next one, which I think we're starting to get into some of the more or less common ones that you might see as an outpatient. But I actually saw a lot of mucositis when I was on the inpatient nutrition service at UAB during my nutrition days, because we would have patients who we would get consulted on for TPN because they would have this profound mucositis. And you can just imagine, when you're talking about your entire GI tract just becoming completely inflamed, starting to slough off, desquamating, forming ulcers. It's miserable. These patients were just in profound pain. And these patients may come in, certainly from an emergency standpoint, you may be looking at, you know, the possibility of this being a Stevens-Johnson syndrome. I mean, they do look very similar to that from an oral standpoint. And then you start talking about, you know, airway issues with airway swelling. But basically, mucositis can occur usually after about day 7 from chemotherapy. So this is going to be a little bit of a delayed reaction. And if it's in the mouth, then it initially starts off as just inflammation, inability to eat. And then as it starts to slough off and ulcerate, they get this pseudomembrane appearance. And again, I've got some pictures on the show notes that you can look at on how bad this looks. But really the main thing that comes down to your mucositis is the possibility of what's called bacterial translocation. So your GI tract has good bacteria. We talk about the microbiome of the system, and that's kind of where the good bugs live. And when you break down the lining of the GI tract, then it increases the likelihood now that these bugs can get where they're no longer the good bugs and they turn into the bad bugs. They go to the wrong side of the tracks and they start mixing with the wrong crowd. And next thing you know, you've got sepsis in these patients, especially if they're also concomitantly neutropenic. So you really got to think about this and worry about it. Your grading system, again, from the NCI score is a grade from 1 to 5. And it's just the severity of the pain that goes with this, as well as whether or not they are able to take in any oral medications or any oral intake. This is generally self-limiting. It usually takes around 14 days to resolve. But what you need to really be thinking about is getting these patients comfortable, giving them some form of analgesia. Sometimes this can be topical. If it's just oral, then sometimes some viscous lidocaine rinses and magic mouthwash will actually go a long way. But they may need some systemic analgesia as well. Worry about antibiotic prophylaxis, especially if it's a profound mucositis. And then nutritional supplementation, really this just comes down to how long have they been NPO and whether or not they need to have some supplemental nutrition, because these patients are at a high risk for developing that. That's the nutrition guy in me, you know, talking here. But this is not something, I don't think I've ever seen this outside of the inpatient hospital service when I was on the nutrition service.
I've seen a few of these patients, usually much more mild in illness. Usually main thing for is kind of pain control and just close monitoring, close follow-up, because some of these people are kind of used to it after they've had a few rounds of chemo of having this, and basically they're coming in more for pain control than anything and just make sure that it's not getting worse.
Right.
So a lot of these are going to fall in your lower grades. Hey, lower grades again.
Lower grades, good. Yep.
But that's kind of my just little pearl there is not all of these are going to look as bad as the pictures that Chris has, but they are still going to look rather painful.
And they're difficult to diagnose.
Yeah, you're going to want to jump to Stevens-Johnson. This is, again, an important point of history taking about chemo and stuff like that.
Right. And you know, if they've got more of an enteritis as opposed to an oral mucositis, then, you know, you're not going to be able to see that. And these patients may be coming in as an undifferentiated abdominal pain. Sometimes you can have some proctocolitis, you know, from this as well. It just depends on the type of medicine, the type of chemotherapy that they're using. So just think about it as one of your complications of chemotherapy, and that it can affect anywhere within the GI tract, and always keep that on your differential in a patient receiving chemotherapy. So the next more common side effect is, again, diarrhea. You've got nausea, vomiting, and then, of course, diarrhea from this. There's three main mechanisms that can occur from this. You have your secretory, which is just an increased intraluminal secretion of electrolytes due to that epithelial damage from the mucositis. You can have an osmotic diarrhea, which has to do with osmotic substances that are leaking out from the blood-brush border of the enterocytes of the intestines. And then you can also have altered GI motility. So when it's inflamed, you may have increased peristalsis and increased emptying. So all three of these things can lead to a chemotherapy-induced diarrhea. Now, the things that you got to differentiate with this is a couple different things. So one, you always want to think about C. diff, because these patients may have been receiving antibiotics at some point, especially if they had chemotherapy and it was myeloablative. They were probably on antibiotics to help while they were reestablishing their bone marrow. So always think about C. diff. Neutropenic enterocolitis can form. It's a form of necrotizing enterocolitis in adults. And again, just like we were talking about with the mucositis, this is just a section of the colon or the intestines that are infected or affected by the mucositis. And again, that can cause some bacterial translocation and some badness from that. And then there are a few different types of chemotherapeutic agents that can cause an ischemic colitis. And the docetaxel regimens are the ones that are most common with this. So, you know, just think about that in the patient who comes in with profound diarrhea, thinking about whether or not this could possibly be an ischemic colitis. Same grading scale, National Cancer Institute, grade 1 is better than grade 5. And it all just has to do with loose stools and whether or not they have incontinence. Typically, grade 3 is the recommendation for admission to the hospital at that point. How you manage it? Your good old friend loperamide is going to be your go-to. Again, whenever you're dealing with antidiarrheal agents, you really want to make sure that this is not a missed infectious diarrhea, because if you do that and you give them loperamide, it can cause a toxic megacolon. It can cause a toxic enterocolitis because the body's trying to get out the bacteria and you're given a medicine to slow it down. So really, really rule out any kind of an infectious process. And then you can do loperamide. And the recommendations are some pretty hefty doses, 4 milligrams initial, followed by 2 migs every 2 to 4 hours until it stops. So this is pretty significant dosing to try to get it to slow down. And then, you know, they talk about using octreotide. You know, we think about this to decrease portal hypertension in variceal bleeds, but this can also help with gastric emptying because it is a somatostatin analog. And you've got some sub-Q dosing that you can give every 8 hours. So you can do this outpatient if you have the patient who's reliable who can come back for these sub-Q injections. But if you're admitting these patients to the hospital, that's going to be your go-to. It's got a 25 to 50 microgram per hour infusion that you can start in the ED while you're waiting to get them admitted. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of chemotherapy diarrhea. Do you have anything that you would like to add to that, Chip?
Yeah, so actually there's a few things I'd want to say about that. So loperamide, you got to be careful about the dosing because you're going to end up causing constipation, because that's basically what it's trying to do. And so with the infectious cause, I would say don't discount C. diff, because that could be a real issue that comes up. And I think that sometimes gets missed at first because, oh, it's just the chemo. So good history taking. And if you've got someone who's having that much diarrhea where you can get the diarrhea in the department, this is a good patient to send off for a stool sample for, even if you're not going to keep them there. But be very careful about your management in this, because you really don't want to cause a toxic megacolon or some other major complication. The other thing in mind, just a quick reminder about C. diff colitis, metronidazole or Flagyl is a good option. The other option is oral vancomycin. So if you're the students out there listening, remember it's oral, not IV. Vancomycin is preferred for C. diff colitis.
Absolutely. It's always good to keep those in the back pocket. The last one that we're going to cover is more of a life-threatening emergent condition that's associated with chemotherapy, really with any kind of cancer management, and that's tumor lysis syndrome. This is actually what precipitated this whole complication of chemotherapy talk, because we were trying to think of something that we could, you know, tag team between Total EM and the Pain Podcast, and this was kind of what started it all. So tumor lysis syndrome, without going into the nuts and bolts of it from a physiologic standpoint, is basically when you're killing cancer cells, you're causing widespread cellular lysis. And when that happens, you have obviously a lot of the leakage of the intracellular cations and anions that get out into the system, which can then cause some problems because it's supposed to be inside the cell, not outside of it. So classically, there's 4 electrolyte abnormalities that you see with tumor lysis syndrome. You see hyperuricemia, which can cause uric acid nephropathy and acute kidney injury, which is more than likely what you're going to see when they come in. Hyperkalemia is very common. Hyperphosphatemia as well. Both the hyper-K and the hyperphos can both cause significant dysrhythmias. And then it can also cause hypocalcemia, because remember, calcium and phosphorus are inversely related. When one goes up, the other goes down. So because of the high phos, your calcium is going to be low. And you remember from your dysrhythmia information is hypocalcemia can precipitate a torsades. All of these can cause significant dysrhythmias. So if you have somebody who comes in with an undifferentiated weird rhythm, weird funky rhythm, WFR, then and they're a cancer patient, think about tumor lysis syndrome. There is a scale. It's called the Cairo-Bishop scale, which basically just tells you what the grading of the severity of the disease is. So basically off of those four elements, uric acid, potassium, phosphorus, and calcium, if you see a 25% change in those, whether they're, you know, for the first three increased, so increased uric acid, increased potassium, increased phosphorus by 25%, or a decrease in calcium by 25%, then that is very suggestive of a laboratory diagnosis of tumor lysis syndrome. There's also a clinical tumor lysis syndrome scale, which looks at three main variables: your creatinine, because all of those can cause acute kidney injury and nephropathy, dysrhythmias. So depending on what you needed to do with it, was there interventions that were needed? Were they symptomatic? Did we need to do something to them, either shock them or give them drugs? And then also neurologic problems. So sometimes you can get some seizures with this. So depending on what happens from a neurologic standpoint, you can grade the risk of the diagnosis of tumor lysis syndrome. So the diagnosis is made with either two or more laboratory abnormalities or one lab and one clinical abnormality. So it's important to know these, because if you're going to call it that, you've got to take into account not only your laboratory diagnoses, but also your clinical diagnoses with that. And you use them together to help make that diagnosis. The treatment it's actually pretty straightforward. It's multi-tiered. It's fluid resuscitation. These patients, the best thing you can do for all of those hyperelectrolyte issues is just give them fluids, because you need to make sure that the kidneys are staying perfused. It'll help dilute out some of that stuff. Certainly correct the electrolytes, but this is after fluid resuscitation. So give fluids first, correct the electrolytes second. Try to renal protect as much as possible in terms of trying to prevent some of that uric acid nephropathy. And then that's kind of what comes in with rasburicase, which is the medication that oxidizes uric acid. So these are the main things that you're going to do for it. But from an emergent standpoint, think about the heart. Think about your electrolytes, get them on telemetry, get a 12 lead, and then figure out what you need to do to help try to correct those electrolytes. That's pretty much all we got for complications. Is there anything that you wanted to impart some words of wisdom to your emergency medicine brethren, Chip?
How sweet of you to say it that way. My biggest thing, and this is true for, doesn't matter who you are, is that it's all about the history at first. If you get a good history, you'll help kind of figure out, is this related to their cancer and to their treatment? You know, we talked all about chemotherapy today and complications, because we talked about general timelines and stuff like that. Having that bit of information is very, very helpful when you're actually going to diagnose something, especially when you're talking about some of these bigger life-threatening conditions like tumor lysis syndrome. Albeit, you know, pretty rare, they are very life-threatening and they are very serious to deal with. And so you want to make sure that you get a good history and physical off of this. My PA professors would be so proud that I said that. But this is also something that you need to rely on a certain amount of laboratory work, especially for like tumor lysis syndrome. Don't forget the EKG. A lot of these conditions we talked about, the EKG was useful. And then the most important thing, and this goes out to all the emergentologists out there and resuscitationists, call early and call often your specialist, because your specialist can really help you out. Yes, we are smart people, and yes, we know how to manage these conditions on an emergent or resuscitative type basis, but they're going to know the details that sometimes you're not expecting. And let's say you have an oncologist who's on call, but it's not that patient's oncologist. It's not uncommon to actually have someone who they're familiar with for whatever reason. So just because their oncologist isn't the one specifically on call does not mean you should say, well, I'm not going to call them because they won't know this particular patient. If it's a patient-specific condition, it's not uncommon that these people are getting some sort of consult within their group too. All right, and again, that was Chris Madej talking all about complications of chemotherapy. Chris, do you have any kind of closing comments you want to mention?
No, I mean, again, I think the main thing it all comes down to is just what we've been saying is, you know, the complications that you see with cancer are pretty ubiquitous across all of those. And with you know, us living longer and having more and more oncogenic type things that are in our environment and things that we're exposed to, the chances of you taking care of a patient with cancer is going to increase the longer you practice. So just knowing what the common complications are, you may not be able to know exactly how to treat all of them right off the bat, but at least recognizing when there could be a potential complication from chemotherapy is going to be very helpful in your clinical practice.
Absolutely. Thank you again so much, Chris. And why don't we have you close out with the tagline for us, if you will, please.
All right. Thanks, Chip, for letting me do the tagline here. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.